case today, United States versus Womack. Andres. Did they leave anything for your argument?
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Justin Enders for Appellant Anthony Womack. We're going to address, I was going to address Spells today. Looks like this is the Spells argument today. I'm also going to address, there's essentially two things I want to address in today's oral argument is the fleeing conviction that in the previous case it was an armed career criminal, and ours is a criminal conviction for a career offender. Both are going to be very similar in a lot of respects, but I wanted to just address at the outset the use of the statistics in the Begay case on that, if I could, just to clarify the difference between ours. In other respects, there's a lot of similarities between the statutes or the cases I'm going to address, but I think the reference to the firearms is a curious reference, and that's where the Spells, that's going to be a criticism I have of Spells. But first I just want to frame sort of the issue here, that our two sentences that we're convicting, we're contesting, one was a career offender sentence based on the crime of violence, and wherein the otherwise involves conduct that presents serious crimes. That the sentencing guidelines list, enumerate a number of them: burglary, arson, extortion, use of explosives. And the Supreme Court over the last couple of years, and Begay and Chambers, of course, has tried to figure out how do we determine which ones are serious, which ones are enough to be essentially present a potential risk of physical injury to another. And one of the ways that the Supreme Court has done that is essentially says that, look, we're going to have to have the same kind and degree of risk. So the same kind of risk it's going to be purposeful, violent, and aggressive. There's also a component that it has to be the same degree of risk as some arson, extortion, burglary of a dwelling. And in that's the first point I want to sort of bring up, is that I don't think there's any dispute here that there was no evidence below the degree of risk involved in this. Other courts have pointed out that it's the government's burden to show what the degree of risk is. No court has addressed the Illinois statute. This court has addressed the Indiana statute on a couple of occasions, and that's what the argument was in the previous case, of course. No one has addressed the Illinois statute, and the government below didn't offer any basis to suggest what the risk was from violating that. And frankly, there's been no evidence here, you know, argued on the appeal what the risk is. Really, the sole basis that the government has offered is the Spells case. And in that case, the court is just discussing the discussions of Spells, but I want to sort of highlight a different aspect of that case, if I could. I don't want to be redundant from the argument before, but in that case, this court used statistics on, essentially, it was for a person possessing a firearm. It says, well, 1 in 4 inmates who possessed a firearm used it to, quote, get away. And they said, well, if you're fleeing and you possess a firearm, it may be more dangerous. You might be more likely to use it. And that the Harrison decision that was discussed in the previous case as well, the 11th Circuit decision, it criticized that. It said that the use of those statistics to show risk, it didn't address the real issue of risk. It addressed a firearms conviction, and that's what I was trying to highlight the difference of. The armed career criminal conviction is concerned armed criminals. So that's why the citation to a firearm was brandished in the Begay case. But in our situation, it's a career offender. The statistics really should be going to show the risk of the crime of fleeing. And the risk of brandishing a firearm or whatnot have nothing to do with the crime of fleeing, whether it's dangerous or not. And that's why the 11th Circuit has said this court's use of those statistics was inconsistent with essentially Begay and Chambers. I think that Spells is, it's a case that has addressed the Indiana statute, has not addressed the Illinois statute. The Indiana statute is different in a couple respects. One is it clearly requires a knowing and intentional violation of the statute. I think there's much in doubt whether the Illinois statute does. We've argued in our brief, I'm not going to repeat the arguments here, that it doesn't. And I think if this court should look at, because we're attacking Spells in two cases in a row now, I guess, but this court wasn't really given the opportunity in Spells to address it. It was a plain error review. And number two, it was argued, I think, 2 days after Begay was handed down. So the parties didn't really, to my understanding, get a chance to brief it. This court really didn't have, Chambers hadn't been issued yet, and Begay was just issued. So the court was sort of at a disadvantage, and I think that's a reason for the sort of curious use of statistics that this court did that really didn't match up to the risk that we should be looking at. And I think it's the government's burden, as the case is indicating. The government hasn't indicated anything. There's no basis in the record, no basis really of anything to indicate what kind of risk is involved, and no court has addressed this Illinois statute. So I think in thinking about the risk, how do we figure out what the risk is? There's really two categories. In almost every case, they've been shown in one of two ways. One is the use of statistics, and I'm not saying that it's the only thing that can be done, but in the three Supreme Court cases, Begay, Chambers, and James, they've all three used statistics. And Begay was a DUI, and the court didn't just say, well, DUI poses a serious risk. They said, well, here's the evidence. Here's what it is. Chambers, again, the government offered evidence of the risks involved using statistics, and the court said, look, you've only offered us a couple cases. That's not enough. And the court says, without any more empirical data, we can't say that that's a serious risk. And again, in James, it was attempted burglary. The statute underlying that required a substantial act to sort of enter the dwelling. And the court said, that, citing empirical data that was in the record, said, well, yeah, that poses a serious risk, just the same as burglary does, which is a listed crime. So that's one way to show a serious risk, is sort of the empirical data. I think Justice Alito has commented that several of the cases have actually turned on that data that has been offered. The other way is illustrated by this court's decision in Jennings. It dealt with the Indiana statute, and that was part of the statute that actually required an element of the crime that the person endangered others, that the person operated a vehicle in a manner that creates a substantial risk of bodily injury to another. So in all the cases before this one, there's been some evidence of risk, whether empirical data or an element of the statute, but something the government, and in Spells, this happened too. There was statistical evidence. Now I've argued that it was doesn't make sense. It was incorrect statistical evidence looking at the wrong risk. I wasn't looking at the risk of the fleeing, but in any event, that distinguishes all the previous cases from this case. There's no evidence of any risk of what the risk is, and we just simply don't know.
Do you attach any significance, Mr. Andrews, to the fact that the statute that you're dealing with doesn't explicitly use the word willfully?
That is one aspect, and we've briefed that before. The statute that we're dealing with doesn't have a willful component. A couple recent cases that have addressed the decision have sort of have cited the elements as essentially a failure to stop after the lights have been engaged. The government has argued that the misdemeanor statute is sort of incorporated there, but even in that statute, there's a willful reference, but the willful is in the disjunctive of extinguishing lights or...
Pretty hard to think of an unwillful fleeing, though, isn't it?
It is. I think it's hard to think of that an unwillful fleeing in the same way it's hard to think of an unwillful DUI. I mean, the court said that was a strict liability, but you also have to intend to drive, and you have to be drunk in doing it. And so in the sense of fleeing, if you're on the way to the hospital with your wife, you're not It's not a willfully intent to be aggressive and violent. It's
that's a very pure, poor analogy, by the way. People that are driving with their pregnant wife and they see a cop car, they're happier than hell. Just lead me to the hospital. Let me take my word for it. I drove a cab for a few years. That's what I spent my time doing.
I understand. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. I think there are other examples. If distrust of police officers and you want to get to a well-lit area.
You're almost finished with your rebuttal.
Yes, I see that.
Thank you. Mr. Boyce.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Good morning. I'm Don Boyce here on behalf of the government. The defendant raised 3 points in his brief. We've only talked about one here today, so I'll focus on that. The government is relying on Spells for the point that the Illinois aggravated fleeing law is, in fact, a crime of violence. This court found in Spells that the Indiana law, which says if you flee from the police in a car, that's a felony, this court found that that was a crime of violence because the court found that it involved dangerous conduct because when someone flees, they invite the police to chase, and that endangers pedestrians, other drivers, and also the police officer. The court also found that fleeing from the police is not a strict liability crime like DUI, and therefore applying the Begay categorical analysis found, you know, fleeing from the police in a car to be a crime of violence. So I think that the only question before the court here today is, unless you're inclined to overturn Spells, which there's been some discussion about, but that was an en banc decision only a year ago, unless you're inclined to overturn Spells, the question is to look at the Illinois statute at issue in this case and see if it falls under the ambit of Spells. The Illinois statute does because it has everything that the Indiana statute has plus one. It involves fleeing from the police in a vehicle, but that alone under Illinois law is a misdemeanor. Under Illinois law, in order for it to be a felony, you have to have an additional factor, and the one that the defendant in this case was convicted of was fleeing from the police in a vehicle at a rate of speed of at least 21 miles an hour over the speed limit. So merely fleeing from the police under Illinois law in a car is just a misdemeanor. If you do it at more than 21 miles an hour over the speed limit, of course that makes it only...
You look like you might be successful in your fleeing and you get nailed with a felony.
Well, in any event, it's certainly more dangerous as it goes to the categorical approach we're looking at here. There's no way that driving faster makes it safer for anybody else. The danger that's addressed in Spells is only increased by driving more than 21 miles an hour over. So I think that just comparing the two statutes, which again is what I think is at issue here today, the Illinois law clearly falls under the ambit of Spells, and unless you're inclined to overturn Spells, the decision of the district court on that point should be affirmed. Does the panel have any questions on that point?
Nope. Thank you.
Then the other two points of the defendant's appeal are that he shouldn't have gotten criminal history points for going to boot camp. That issue is clearly under the ambit of this court's prior holding in Gadsdick. There's no reason to revisit that or to overturn that. And the defendant's last point deals with the crack powder issue that's been foreclosed by Welton, and I think that he's conceded that by not addressing that in his reply brief. So unless there are any questions about those two points, yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. How much time? You have 1 minute, Mr. Andres.
Just because Gadsdick was addressed just a minute ago, I'd just like to point out, clarify that this, I think Gadsdick is wrong legally for a reason or two. I don't think that this court needs to overrule it to hold that the boot camp in this case qualified for less than 1 year and 1 month of the sentence. I think in Gadsdick, sort of the legal error was that the court said there was no supervised release, but clearly in this statute there is supervised release. I think that was sort of either the statute was not the same as it was, as it currently is, but there was only about two reasons this court gave in Gadsdick that it wasn't a suspended sentence. One was the supervised release. That doesn't hold up. The government didn't address it, but it's the rest of that is briefed. I won't do that. The other issue is the judicial involvement. And in each of the cases the government cites, the courts say, yeah, there needs to be some judicial involvement. In this case, there wasn't judicial involvement both at the beginning, when the court, pursuant to a recommendation from the prosecutor, essentially said, yeah, I think you should be in this shorter sentence, and actually let him go home for a week then sentence him to the shorter time. So I think the my time is up. Unless you have any other questions, I just ask that you reverse this.
Mr. Andres, you took this case by appointment as well, did you? Well, you have appreciation of the court, and you traveled some distance for this case, too, as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We move, and the court will be in recess.